Right now, it's time for our first and last new acquisition of the evening. Whatever Became Of is the title of the series, and the subject tonight is Fibber McGee and Molly. This new acquisition is an interview with Jim Jordan of Fibber McGee and Molly fame. Not too much more information about the program, but entertaining nonetheless. Whatever Became Of Fibber McGee and Molly, a new acquisition, next for a Friday WRVO Playhouse. Enjoy.
Of some $1,000 of tape of some of the old radio programs, and we played some of those programs for our audience, and the mail response was just tremendous.
Exactly.
And so I know that we're going to have an enthusiastic listening audience to our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I might point out that you're here actually as a guest of our Ranger Andy, aren't you?
That's right. That's right.
And
visiting in their home over in Kent.
That must be a delightful experience for all of you, kind of talking about the old days, because Andy was with the Al Pierce Show for many years.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, we want to find out about Fibber McGee and Molly and how this great show got its start. How many years were you on the air at that time slot?
About from 1935 to 1960. How long would that be?
Oh, gosh, that's almost 30 years.
That's right.
That's a long time. 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
The show, As Fibber McGee and Molly, as a half-hour radio show, went off the air in about 1954, didn't it?
53 or 54, I forget which, one of those years.
Yeah.
And then we did a 15-minute show across the board for 1 year, and then we did Monitor for about 3 years.
Yeah.
In fact, when Marion became ill in 1960, in February, the cancer was discovered, and we were just, the contract was made out for 3 more years of Monitor at that time, and but we never finished signing it. NBC had signed it and sent it to us,
mm-hmm.
but then when we told them, we thought we'd go on, you know, and be able to go on for a while, but we didn't know how long. So we never signed it. We didn't go on.
Well, that was one of the great losses to radio. But you were with NBC for all those years, weren't you?
We were with NBC for over 30 years. Yeah,
well, that's mm-hmm. quite an association. Did
yeah.
you happen to see the CBS television show, the one which was a tribute to broadcasting? They ran it about a week ago on Sunday night.
Yes, I was sitting there in the room where it was on, and I turned my head to say something to somebody, and so I didn't get to see it.
Well, you were there.
Yeah, I was there.
Do you know how you got there?
This is a mystery to me, really. It went by real fast, and we never made any bit of television ever in our lives. And I'm looking at ourselves to see how old we were at that time. And that must have been made quite a few years ago, because I saw hairs that I don't have anymore. And we just don't know where that came from. It was a mystery to me. It wasn't a motion picture technique. It was a television kind of a technique, and it certainly didn't have anything to do with radio. But we certainly did it, but I just don't recall where or how or why or what.
I was telling you before we went on the air that I had the feeling that it might have been some kind of a war bond rally film, some of those shorts that they made during the war.
That's right, and yes, I remember that you mentioned that, and that's probably what it was, something like that. Or war bonds would probably be about right. That would be about the only way that NBC would allow us to do that on CBS in those days. And this was CBS, I guess.
That's right.
And that's what mystified us more. And it was real. It did go over real fast. And it must have been put together and made and done for this purpose. So otherwise, it wouldn't work that way.
That's right. One of the things I remember about the film sequence was the famous sound effect of the door, you know, the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that it wasn't done the way it was portrayed in the movie.
No, the movie technique was entirely different. We would do the visual part of it in the movie, and then the sound would be added.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, on radio, the way we did it, there was no door, there was nothing. The man piled this stuff up on a stepladder way up to the ceiling, and then on a cue, he knocked it over. And, it couldn't have been pictured the way we actually did.
Well, I think that was one of the great trademarks of the Fibber McGee and Molly show, the hall closet.
The strange thing about it was that, especially in the last 5, 7, 8 years that we did it, we would do that as many as three times a year. That's all. Peter, and everybody that ever says anything about Sir McGee and Molly now, they always think of the closet, and they think that Sir McGee and Molly was a closet. You know? And it's the truth, so we wouldn't do it over two or three times in a year.
You felt that the gag was wearing thin.
We didn't want it to wear thin. We wanted to keep it alive as long as we possibly could. And we talked about it and did keep it alive.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't actually do it. Boy, we'd have a big meeting about whether to do it or not.
Yeah.
It's certainly been alive and seems to be more alive now than it was when we were doing it.
And what would Fibber say after the last tinkle, after the last crash?
Gotta straighten out that closet one of these days.
And the laughs across the nation, I'm sure, can still be heard if you listen carefully enough. Well, Jim, how did Fibber McGee and Molly originate?
Well, how long is this interview going to be?
We have no time limit.
I see. Well, we have to catch the plane at 10:30.
All right. Well, we'll try to cut it short.
It's really a pretty long story. I'll tell it if you can stand it.
I sure can.
We started in radio. I started in vaudeville before Marion and I were married in 1917. I was 1 year in vaudeville, went in the Army, and then ended up doing a show in the Army. And after I came out of the Army, our home was in Peoria, Illinois. And we were married right as I went in the Army. So we tried to stay home and try and stay out of show business for a while. And my wife was a piano teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't stay out very long, so we kept going back in. We had a little concert coming in 3 or 4 years and did very well until our second child was born, and then we had to get off the road. And we were traveling, and we had to do then.
Mm-hmm.
And with that time, we went into vaudeville, the two of us. The only time we were in vaudeville was just a couple of years, and we played more picture houses in vaudeville, and we were a piano, singing act, and never spoke a word. We did comedy tunes, sang a little comedy song.
And you were known as the Jordans?
Yeah, Marion and Jim Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we went on the radio in Chicago in 1926.
Which was a local Chicago outlet.
Yeah, local. No dough.
Mm-hmm.
No. And we worked at it a while, and then we got to go back in vaudeville. But by this time, the fact that we were on radio upped the value a little bit in the theaters in those days, you know, even in vaudeville. We were radio stars. You know, we'd been on radio about 3 months, and we were stars.
Mm-hmm.
And we were coming to New York. We had a deal to do the Low Time. With Tim and Irene Ryan had picked us up to meet them. And on the way out of through Chicago, we ran into a fellow who was a musical director over at a station called WENR, which was in 1927.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over and interviewed him, and we went to work on that station, and we never were off one day from that time until Marion became ill.
And who originated the idea of Fibber McGee and Molly?
Well, that evolved to a whole series of events. We were doing a show on WENR. We worked on farm programs and did old couple of farm rural people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that evolved into the old people. And then we did another show called The Smith Family, which other people were involved. And Marion did the Irish voice on that, which later became Molly. And then later did another show and called. We ran into a man on the farm program called Russ, E.W. Russ, and he had known about a little store down in Columbia, Missouri. An old guy that ran this store didn't have anything. He had everything, but he had the knack of telling people that he was, if he didn't have anything, well, I'm smack out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have it in the morning. And we could put a sign up called on Halloween night called Smack Off. So this man told us this story, and we thought this would be a good idea. So we just put it together, and we made a deal with Don Quinn to write it. And in those days, if you didn't write your own material, you were no good. You know, the idea that you hired a writer, you kept that quiet. You didn't let anybody, know that. You ought to work quick. So he started writing Smack Out, and then NBC bought this radio station, and we didn't want to go to NBC because we were playing theaters and doing pretty well. And the reason we did well was because our appearances were announced on the radio station, and NBC wouldn't allow it. So we went over across the river to a Columbia station, WMAQ in Chicago, and did this, started the show actually over there, and we were only there 6 months when that station was sold to NBC. Then we had to go to NBC. It was 1931 that happened.
This was still Smack Out, though.
That was still Smack Out. Mm-hmm. And we went to NBC, and we stayed over there for about 3 or 4 months after the NBC bought it, and then they moved us over to the merchandise mart with the rest of the NBC operation. And we did that show for 4 years before anything happened.
So it brings us up to about what, 1934?
1934.
Mm-hmm.
We heard about the Johnson Company through an outside source. They were looking for something, and they had listened to 20 radio shows. They wanted to hear us because Mrs. Lewis, who was the Johnson and married to Jack Lewis, who was the head of the advertising agency, mm-hmm. the Mason Brothers. We got him. He listened to a Smack Out for about 6 months. And she knew all about us, and she got her husband to listen. And he got interested, and he wanted to buy us, but they didn't want NBC to know that they wanted to buy us, you see.
Yeah.
And otherwise, that's right. So they heard all these shows, and we actually went over to another studio on the other end of town and sneaked an audition for the Johnson Company with the old guy in the store, and we put the Marion voice, who was Marion's voice, Irish voice that she had been doing in the Smith family, put them all together and did this audition, and Don wrote it, and they bought it.
Mm-hmm. And did Don originate Fibber McGee? Was that the...
Yes. And the way that came about, this old liar, you know, the Johnson Company said something one day, it seems to me that we should have a name, we should name something besides Marion and Jimmy Jordan, maybe a name that would be more significant of a liar would have some value. And this was in a meeting one day, and the next morning Don came in and he threw the paper down on the table and said, I don't know, Fibber McGee.
Yeah.
But that's where that all happened. And of course the name Molly we had before.
Yeah.
He did, and that's how the whole ugly mess started. All like that.
Well, that's a great story. That is a tremendous story. And, of course, the Fibber McGee and Molly program became a radio institution for those many years.
Yes.
Tuesday night was the great listening night for radio. You started out with, let's see, who preceded you? I think Frank Crummett and Julia Sanderson for a while, didn't they, from 9 to 9:30? And then, of course...
I don't know. I don't remember that. I mean, they did for a while.
Yeah. Amos and Andy came in there.
Yes, Amos and Andy came in there, and Red Skelton came in there, and Snooks. Baby Snooks preceded us for quite a while.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Bob Hope followed at 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So that was that strong Tuesday night lineup that one heard about. And there were so many people associated with you. Your announcer, Harlow Wilcox, mm-hmm. who I believe is no longer living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A very fine announcer.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the characters who were associated with Fibber McGee and Molly through the years. And I was trying to think of them this morning at home as I was shaving in the mirror and trying to come up with some of these characters. Remember, and I'm sure you do, the fellow who always looked through his pockets and came up with a ticket for a short beer.
Bill Thompson. Bill Thompson did that guy. I can't think of his name.
Yeah.
And did Wallace Wimple,
Wallace,
the old timer, and Nick Kapopoulos, and I don't think that character had. What was his name?
I wish I
could. I'll think of it later.
Well, it's for a short beer.
He did all this, and while he was with us, he was with us about 20 years, and while he was with us, he got interested in boys' club sports, and spent a lot of all his spare time doing this work. Amazing thing. And after the half-hour show went off the air, he went with the Union Oil Company. That's the big oil operation on the West Coast. I don't think they're here.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
And Union Oil. And he carried right on doing the boys' club work and doing the appearance of banquets and sort of same work that he did all the time with us.
Sure.
In the name of the Union Oil Company.
Wallace Wimble was married to Sweetie Puss, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Mm-hmm.
My big old wife, Sweetie Puss.
Mayor
Latrivia.
That's Gail Gordon.
Right. And he's very active.
He's with Lucy.
He's working with Lucy now, and he was on the books, I guess, yeah, when that was on television.
Mm-hmm.
And Mayor Latrivia, Doc Gamble?
Doc Gamble has passed on, too.
And who portrayed Doc Gamble?
Arthur Q. Bryant.
I recall while listening to Sybil McGee and Molly that Gene Glenn joined the program
mm-hmm.
for a while.
Yeah.
I can't think of Gene's last name, but
Carol.
He was Gene Carroll, right.
Yeah.
And as you may know or may not know, Gene and Glenn were with TIC for a number of years around the early 40s.
Oh, were they as a team?
Yeah, and I believe that Gene and Glenn originated from here on the network, did it, for a while? Yeah, I used to listen to that program, never realizing that it was coming from TIC in Hartford because I was listening out of New York, you see. And that would be about 8:30 in the morning, 8:15, somewhere.
Well, they were in Cleveland for the time.
Yeah.
And I had worked with, we had worked with Gene, with another partner way back in the Nodo days, named Grady. And that was Carol and Grady. They were singing acts also.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, he did sing. And Glenn, I knew, and he had a partner named Ford. They were one of the first people to be paid
mm-hmm.
on radio in Chicago. They worked for WLS, which was owned by Sears Roebuck.
Mm-hmm.
And they were paid. It was Ford and Glenn. I think the next team to be paid was Carell and Gosden. They tried out for a job, and we tried out for it. It was called the Tribune. And they got the job. And we didn't get it. And they started Sam and Henry right after that. And
right.
That was 16 years then.
Mm-hmm.
But Gene, when he went with Ford, I knew him very well because I was tempted to talk to Ford myself because we weren't doing too well. We had children and we didn't it. Might have been a good idea and we talked about it and decided not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did very well. And then later, years later, we had Gene on the Sydney and Molly show. So we did the Lena.
Yeah.
I think it was called Maid Lena.
There's another young man who developed a character named
Lena. Yeah, that was Marlon Hurt.
Right.
He was with the same trio in
Chicago. And Marlon Hurt went on to his own CBS half-hour show and then died shortly thereafter of a heart attack.
Jim, we'll have to talk more about some of the people with whom you worked, and of course, the show itself, Sybil McGee and Molly. Jim Jordan, visiting with us this week here on Americana. Some delightful memories here. And a delightful man to meet and to interview, too. Jim Jordan and Marion Jordan started out their radio career, as Jim told us last evening in Chicago. They hired Don Quinn, kept it a big secret, and they started out with a show based around a character they named Smackout. And from that, the Johnson people became very interested in sponsors, and they developed Sybil McGee and Molly. We were talking about some of the wonderful characters that appeared on that show with you last night, Jim. You never did any of the voices other than Sybil, did you?
No, not on the Sybil McGee Monster.
But Molly
did,
it.
Too, in the beginning.
Did you?
Of course, in the beginning, on the Smackout show, we did everything.
Mm-hmm.
We ran our own clock and did our own producing. And did all the voices. We had nobody.
So.
And no music. Man played the piano and we did everything.
Mm-hmm.
We did everything. That's why they kept us on so long, not being so. he was a union musician, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting $200 a week.
That's pretty good for those.
Yeah,
days.
But she got 140 of it. I got 60 and paid down 140.
Well, you had $20 for selling money.
I had $20 left.
4 years. Couldn't get into any kind of trouble that way. Did Don Quinn write the show? Right
from
through?
The beginning.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning. Then he later on had help.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Molly did a character, a little girl.
A little girl, yes.
Yeah. I'll tell you, when I first became aware of Fibber McGee and Molly, because 9:30 was really past my bedtime at the time of the show, but I used to listen from the bedroom to the big radio in the living room. And this was the time when Molly was out ill. So I think she had been out ill for a while. Because
18 months.
Was she out that long? About, 38, 39?
37.
Hey, I go back farther than I thought. Well, I stayed up longer than I thought, one or the other. And I remember that when she joined the show, she was a newcomer as far as I was concerned.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then the association began. Now, you did go out to Hollywood.
Yes, we went out to Hollywood, and actually, while she was ill, the show was moved out there. And we went out in January, we came out in March.
Mm-hmm.
And he around again pretty quickly. So we went on out and she came in March of 1939.
Mm-hmm. And while you were, this was probably in the early 40s, you did a movie, at least one movie that I know.
No, we made five.
You did made five. Mm-hmm.
So they found out what was the matter. In fact, we could have gone on with movies, but it became kind of futile along at that time. We just a lot of work, and we were back to the no-dough days again, making movies, because with the tax, he scared all up, and we had a lot of work to do for the government at that time.
Mm-hmm.
With the war, and so we just a lot of work for nothing, so we dropped it. Just to make work.
Was there a reaction as far as the public? Was it well accepted as a motion picture?
Yeah. Uh huh. Yes, we did very well. We did very well. Especially money wise. We made money.
Mm-hmm.
And, we had a lot to learn about making pictures, which we naturally done. I've been sorry since, but we didn't, because Marion was very adept. She could have done very well in
pictures. Yeah.
It bothered me all the time. It was so slow. You know? I'd go on the set at 9 o'clock in the morning, and all my energy was gone by 11.
Yeah.
I just worked myself to death. I didn't have anything left. The afternoons were all lost.
What was a work week like for you as far as the radio program was concerned? Did it begin Wednesday morning after the show?
No, no. It began Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And we took Wednesday and Thursday off. Today we tried to keep ourselves free.
Mm-hmm.
Then started Friday, Saturday.
What would you do? Would you be working with Don Quinn, going over his material?
Oh, we'd meet on Friday, and then we would meet again Saturday, and we would meet Sunday. That was just with us and the writers, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then on Monday, the cast would come in and we'd have a reading, and then they'd go back to work and we'd take it on Thursday morning again. The structure, the building of the show and everything, of course, was all done beforehand.
Sure. How many rehearsals would you have prior to going on the air?
Two.
Did one address rehearsal?
Yes, we'd have address on Tuesday about noontime.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an audience for that?
No.
No. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessary to gauge where the laughs were going to fall and so on.
Well, they didn't fall on that. They didn't always, believe me.
Well, I suppose that many times you misjudge material. Yeah. You sort of think it'd be funny when it doesn't turn out that way. What, in all of those years, did any real bloopers occur with regard to the show? Think of?
Well, I there were some words just about my mother would never allow me to say those words. It's kind of hard to tell.
Do people forget characterizations? Or?
No.
No.
We had all, the best people in the world. We had all around us all the time.
Mm.
Hal Perry, who did Gildersleeve.
Right, Gildersleeve originated on your show.
That's right, Gail Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fellow from the bandstand who was in Hartford here a long time, Ed Bailey.
Sure.
And we had a character called Kramer, the druggist. He never brought on. we always just talked about him. He was an offstage character.
Uh-huh.
But when we got Ed, why, he did Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
He was great. He was really great. And he left us to come back to New York to do a show. And then he did that show, and he later came back and did Kramer again for a little while. Whenever he'd be in town, he'd do it.
I see. And for most of the time then, from 39 on, the show originated from the Hollywood studio.
Always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I had an idea it was out of New York, but...
No. We started in New York.
Yeah.
We did the first 4 weeks in New York.
Yeah. But tell me, Jim, the whole industry has changed considerably over the last 15 years. Do you think you've really lost something as far as dramatic radio is concerned? In other words, the depiction of characters and action on radio?
Well, I don't know. Things had to happen to radio, but I do think that the industry, when television came along, if it hadn't been so tied in, I think radio would have been kept alive a little better. In fact, I think radio is doing better now than it did 5 years ago, don't you?
Yes, by all means.
But it's to say that it would go back to what it was 20 years ago, it's silly to say that. It'll find its own niche, and I think it has.
The thing is,
it'll change a lot more than it has too.
I think the one thing that disturbs a lot of people is the fact that it really was an art medium. I mean, the depiction of a story, of drama on radio was nothing more than sound effects.
That's
and it's been lost. It's gone. There's absolutely nothing left today. We run the Lone Ranger. We have the old transcription.
Oh, yeah. You run
it? And the reaction to that is tremendous.
It is.
Yeah.
You don't have the Hornet.
We did.
I heard about the Hornet.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know.
We did up until we ran out of episodes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that so?
And prior to that, we had the Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
So that there is a reaction to it. But I was wondering what your feelings were.
I think as a new medium, it's so much faster than anything else. It'll always be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think you'll see a change in radio program. I think if the stations find out that if they spend a little money on programming, they'll gain thereby. As soon as we reach that point, well, they'll start doing it.
Yeah. And what are you doing now?
Nothing.
Just relaxing, taking on your retirement gracefully. Is that
I don't know what I'm taking gracefully or not. I have to take it. I think about doing things all the time. I just don't. It's pretty. Once you get out of the swing, it's a little difficult to.
You miss it.
Yes, I do. Until I have something ahead of me that I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing I know, I find I'm not sleeping the night before. And, how do you see that?
Well,
if you don't have to. And, I do miss it, but when it comes to that point, I don't.
Right.
I don't miss it anymore if I stop thinking about it.
Where do you make your home now?
In Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. So you're out east?
Yeah.
No, no, kind of a jaunt. Is that the idea?
We're going to Europe.
Oh, wow.
We're meeting 10:30 tonight for Lisbon. I'm married again, and my wife is the widow of Will Jorgensen.
Yes. A very well-known
radio.
Radio.
Well, that's a record.
Yeah, record. Yogi made, what was his character?
Yogi
was the character.
His name is Harry Stewart.
Harry Stewart, yes.
Yeah.
And Harry was killed in an automobile accident just about 10 years ago.
No. Well.
A little longer than that, perhaps. Yeah, I think it is.
I'm just adding it up. I couldn't add it up beyond 6, I didn't think, but I think it is almost 10 years.
Well, I understand you met Mrs. Stewart in Hawaii.
Yeah, that's right. We didn't know each other, and we'd gone to the same... There was a Christmas party that a man with Variety gave for years and years, Jack Hellman, and we were spending together, but we'd never met each other.
Mm-hmm.
I never met him either. So shortly after, we were married, she has a grandson, and says... several grandchildren, and this little guy is 7 years old at this time. And he was talking to one of his kid friends, and he said to this kid, He's dropped the names, you see. He said, do you know Sugar McGee? Of course, he said, no. He didn't know Sugar McGee, but... So Timmy said, well, my grandmother is married to Sugar McGee and Molly.
That's a great story. Jim, I want to thank you very much for visiting here on Americana with us. It's been a great way to celebrate Radio Month, which is the month of May, incidentally. And thank you so much for bringing back so many pleasant memories.
Thank you. Thank you very much.